Welcome, everyone. Can you all hear me okay? Okay. It's interesting. Most people are on the left side, so I'll try and look in that direction. I don't know quite how that happened, but and I don't know if it's a little hot. Feel free to maybe open windows on the right side, since everybody's on the left side and they won't get chilled, I guess. So I gave a talk back in November called Karma and the End of Karma. How many people were here for that? Okay, so I can use the same stuff because they're not the talk tonight is related to that, but I'm really going to come at it from a different angle, and it's really just rich material. So I wanted to start by just doing a little bit of, you could call it meditation. Just to start by, you don't really have to get in any formal position or anything, but just check how the nature of mind is. And by mind, I mean just this thought process, this conceptual ability to abstract, project, plan, organize, thinking about problems, that sort of thing. Just check how that is, if anything's going on, maybe thoughts about what happened today or what might happen in the next rest of this talk or when you go home this evening. And then check this heart sense, this felt sense. How do things feel? It could be emotions or just feeling like a sense of okayness or maybe anxiety or just what's there right now. And then just drop down into the body and explore a little bit how you know you have a body. I mean, not looking at it so much, but what's it like to have a body? Maybe noticing how the body expands and contracts on the in-breath and out-breath. And checking the eyes and the lips and just allowing them to soften. You might notice the energetic quality of the breathing process, that on the in-breath there's kind of an uplifting, increase in energy. And then when you breathe out, there's a dropping down, a relaxation. And so if you're feeling tired, then you can take deeper in-breaths. I mean, not continually, but it tends to raise the energy level. And if there's some anxiety, just to really let the breath totally come out, not to force it, but just allow the belly to soften, drop in your lap, and just, So just notice how things felt before we started, how they feel now. I know some of you have been sitting, so it might not make much difference. So this is body, heart, mind, and it's going to be a theme of a lot of the talk tonight. And how patterns in body, heart, mind are formed and how we can release them, let them go. And the reason I asked how many people were here when I gave the talk, and I want to say, since we have a limited amount of time, the talk I gave in November is on dharmaseed.org. It's just called Karma. When I gave it, it was Karma and the End of Karma, but somehow the title got shortened. And a lot of what I say is from a series of talks given by Ajahn Suchito. And they're on, if you search for Kama and the End of Kama, Kama is K-A-M-M-A. There's a nice little PDF file. It's a really rich document in practice, so you might want to look at that. So this word, so when I talk about patterns, this word karma or kama has a lot to do with it. So every New Year's, I have a lot of Dharma friends over here at my house for like a brunch, and they're just wonderful people. I mean, what they all say is no one kind of puffs themselves up. They're just really present here. And puffing yourself up is a pattern. It's a way of kind of making yourself look a little better than you feel you are, in some sense. And anyway, a few years ago, someone left a little black block of wood at my house, and they wouldn't really own up to who did it, although I figured it out later. And I didn't bring it this time, but I did write down what it says, and it had some letters carved on it. And this is one definition of karma. It says, karma means I can rest easy at night, knowing all the people I treated badly had it coming. So it's worth doing that twice, since there's only a few people here last time, but that's probably the last time I can get away with it. So that's not exactly probably what we tend to think of as kindness, compassion, the intention of Buddhism. So what is karma? Karma is a Sanskrit word, and the Pali, the textual language that the Buddhist teaching was written down is kama. And basically it means action. And even it's the same as intention, really. It's the thing that kind of pulls together things so we can take an action. And those actions can be of body, speech, or mind, which is why I try to get you to do this little meditation, is to kind of start embedding this notion of these three aspects of what we call ourselves. And it's really useful to actually, rather than think of yourself as some solid, unchangeable object, as these processes of body, heart, mind, these processes that affect each other. And they're intelligent processes. They can learn, and they sense things. So the body, you know, if you start running, it knows it has to breathe harder. If something happens that maybe is dangerous, the adrenaline shoots through. The heart sense kind of perceives things, which is its way it interprets things, and sort of, oh, this feels safe, or, you know, or it's dangerous, or something like that. And of course, the conceptual piece, which I'm going to call mind tonight, is the thing that kind of organizes, plans, thinks through, and they're all interactive. They affect each other. So, just to be clear, I mean, I think the body we have a pretty good sense of. I'm using heart tonight in a sense of a kind of felt sense of things. It's emotions, but it's more than that. It's qualities like determination, confidence. The heart is something that interprets things. And let me just, I'll come to what I mean by that in a minute. By the mind, I mean both internal and external speech. So internal would be just thoughts you're having, and external would be actual verbal speech. And I'm separating mind out here as just that part that's conceptual. It doesn't feel anything. It, you know, it can see a dead body and say, oh yeah, it's 6 feet long, da da da. It doesn't really have any reaction to it. But the heart says, oh, that could be me, or it has a reaction to it. So that's kind of the structure we're talking about here. And it's tricky because sometimes in Buddhism there's a Pali word, citta, which is usually translated heart-mind. So... But usually they don't really separate them too much in Buddhism. But in this particular structure, which Ajahn Suchito uses a lot, he separates out the thinking piece from the felt sense, the emotional piece. And these actions of body, speech, and mind have consequences. They have consequences both internally and externally. So, for example, if you're in the habit of yelling at people and being angry and criticizing them all the time, they're probably not going to want to hang around you too much. That's the external part of it. And the internal part is that we tend to, we form patterns, habitual ways of behaving. We don't even know they're habitual. It's just we've been doing it so long, it just seems like a reasonable way to be. We kind of adapted a stance on the world, and we live the world through that stance. And you know, it's useful sometimes, but the problem with it is that we don't really see things clearly. We see them through this lens, the stance we're taking. So I want to just say a little bit more about how this heart emotive response works. So I was watching some YouTube video. I don't know how I ended up watching it, but there's this guy walking down the street. And I was driving over here this morning. I thought, does anybody walk around without a cell phone and, you know, in their face? I mean, it's just amazing. You're not talking on the phone. So this guy is walking down the street in Los Angeles, and he's just like a lot of people walking through, when I go through Harvard campus, you know, their faces engaged on the cell phone. And then he looks up, and there's this bear in front of him. I don't know why there was a bear in Los Angeles, but there was, you know. There's actually a chipmunk in my wife's car right now, which is kind of fascinating. He's living there, I think, so I don't know what he's going to do tomorrow morning when she starts it up. But you know, what happens? Well, there's like the heart sees bear, and it like, you know, it doesn't have to know it's a bear. It's just like, oh, this is dangerous, you know. It's like, it interprets this as something threatening. That's the emotive response. And then there's a reaction. You know, it ramps the body up. The body ramps up in response to this heart response. Adrenaline starts flowing. Maybe the conceptual piece is saying, okay, I remember, like, if I see a bear, what am I supposed to do? You know, and maybe you'll get out of here or whatever you do. Well, that's kind of how the process works. Or maybe we see someone who just looks kind, or we, you know, have a nice image of them, we feel welcomed. Or we might see someone, it could be really biased kind of thing, or it could be a racial kind of thing, or just some social conditioning about how we think people should look. I remember when I came home from the holidays, during the Christmas holidays, when I was out of grad school, and I had very long hair and a beard, and my uncle walked in and said, "You bum," and walked out and didn't speak to me for 20 years. So that's kind of a perception, right? I mean, he was like trained that long hair and a beard is a bad person. So we have these kind of things. I mean, we've been very conditioned I couldn't resist. Reminded me of my younger days. We've been trained to perceive things a particular way. We have all kinds of values, socially conditioned to be productive and that sort of thing. And that conditioning is what the heart responds to. It perceives things, it interprets things. And then from that, we act. Okay. And these actions kind of have patterns. Maybe you know, you're... something really bad's happened to you in your early years, and so you tend to be defensive. And so then maybe you're trying to control things all the time out of fear. You're a really controlling person. Or what other good examples would we have here? Where it just might be moods. You know, it just might be kind of a sense of sadness or joy or loneliness. Any of these things are kind of patterns. And the thing is that, so this is what we call patterns or programs. This is what I'm referring to in the title, is these kind of ways we've been conditioned. It's not our fault. You know, we just came into this world with a certain set of genetics, and we have a family, and we have the whole social environment we're in, and we've been trained to be a particular way. And this is really helpful. It's one helpful in terms of just looking at yourself, and rather than beating up on yourself, I should be this way and I'm all this way, is to realize that you're the way you are because of causes and conditions. And the same thing is true about people who probably really annoy the heck out of you, who maybe you're furious with. I did this exercise where I was supposed to make a list of everybody I ever knew and go through and try and feel love for them. And I hadn't remembered, but my first girlfriend who dumped me twice, once when we were supposed to get married, and I came home to see her, and she just found out she was marrying some professor at the college she was working at. You know, and I sort of went through this process of trying to, feel love for her. And, you know, I actually could do it. I mean, at first I thought, God, there's still some charge here. But then you could kind of say, oh, well, she's like she is out of causes and conditions. I mean, it's not the kind of way you want, but, you know, that's sort of the process is really if we start looking at ourselves with causes and conditions, start looking at other people as causes and conditions, imperfect, make mistakes, do sometimes incredibly terrible things, then maybe we can just say, oh, just like me, makes mistakes. Now, maybe they make a lot more mistakes, a lot more serious, but maybe that's because they just had worse conditions than we did. And these programs aren't our fault, and they're habitual, but we can do something about them because what we are these dynamic processes, body, heart, mind. We're not something solid, and they can learn. And what we can do is pause and learn to meet them and allow them to go through some process where they clear, they're released. And that's partly what I want to talk about tonight is how we do that. So a lot of times we talk about awareness in this practice, and it can seem like a heady thing. You know, I'm up here in the head and I'm kind of watching. But really, we want to practice holistic awareness. We want to be aware of this body, the heart, the mind, how it is. Okay. And when these three, what I could call, what should I call them? These three processes are in balance, there's really a sense of ease, of being okayness. When the body feels okay, when it's relaxed and at ease, the heart tends to feel okay. And it, you know, so much of what, you know, people who've been around me know, I just talk about body, 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 because it's so important. It's our ground. And it's the place we want to go when we're having really strong emotions, to just ground ourselves, a sense of presence, of here-ness. It sort of helps the mind not spin so much. But, you know, we've been so conditioned as society to achieve, accomplish, get things done. You know, our whole measurement is how productive we are. And we've also been conditioned to look certain ways. Just all kinds of things that sort of drive us. So, you know, what we do is we get up in the head, we go to work, and we got all these things to achieve, or maybe you don't even have to achieve that much. Sometimes you just have a pattern of really not feeling inadequate. The only way you feel good enough is if you accomplish a lot. I have a friend who, she is so accomplished, it's unbelievable. I mean, she's doing something in a field that was very hard to make a living. She's published all kinds of books. And yet, if she doesn't get the next book published and it doesn't get wide circulation, she's not worth anything. That's the kind of conditioning we have. So we get up in the head, we push, we drive, and we separate. We lose contact with the heart. We lose contact with the body. You know, when you start thinking about all the things you have to get done or what might happen to you, the heart doesn't deal very well with all these abstractions. It upsets it. It tightens it up. It doesn't feel good. And, of course, the body gets all stressed out. Not only because we're kind of like a head on wheels, you know. We're just running around trying to get things done, totally disconnected. We're just not whole. So the body gets stressed out. Sometimes we pump ourselves up with coffee, go get some food to suppress the lousy feelings. I mean, you know, I think it's just part of our society. Of course, when the body doesn't feel good, the heart doesn't feel good, and they're dynamics. They feed each other. And the heart drives these things as well. I mean, it's not just because we have all this training. The heart sense sort of feels like it wants to be okay. So, you know, we've been conditioned that to be okay, we have to meet certain social norms. And we objectify ourselves. We don't do things because they feel right for us. We do things because we've been socially conditioned at certain ways of dressing, certain ways of behaving is an acceptable way, and we suppress a lot of what we really feel and are. We don't really show our true self. And this doesn't lead to happiness. So what I wanted to do tonight is talk a little bit about how to work with this. And my experience has been that probably the most dominant issue, no matter what the age group is this sense of inadequacy and this inner critic that tells you how inadequate you are. You know, it uses words like "you should." Every time you hear that, you can just like, okay, this is a danger signal. "You must." You would be okay if you just tried harder. But of course, you can't do that, right? So this program is a result of the fact that we live in this non-empathic environment. It's a competitive environment. We have to accomplish, perform, be something. There are all these images about how we should look. And so what happens as a result of that is that empathy and wholeness gets jettisoned in favor of achievement and performance. So this body, heart, mind, that naturally when it's balanced, it feels at ease, is now kind of separated, often up in the head. When we have the inner critic, what happens is the mind splits into the harsh inner critic and the inadequate me. You should do this. You should control this better. You should lose some weight. You should get a better job, or you should do better at the job you have. It's just like endless. Now, one of the and I've been using the word patterns. I also use the word programs. It's like you push a little button and it runs. You know, someone says something unpleasant to you and zoom, or someone praises you and you feel good. Okay. We tend to, our identity, the sense of who we are these patterns. I'm a sad person. I'm a happy person. I'm a kind person. I'm a mean person. Whatever kind of patterns we have, that's who we think we are. But they're just programs. They're way we've been conditioned to live. And we kind of think that we are running the show, that we can control things, that we're kind of outside the mind. This inner critic's outside the mind telling you all these things you should do. But really, where is the inner critic? It's a thought, isn't it? It's a program. And it's in the mind. It's not outside the mind. It's one program running in the mind that's been conditioned about how we should be, and another program running in the mind, which is this little me. And yet, we kind of identify with the me and listen to this voice outside that seems to be out there running the show, when there's just really these conditioned patterns that are inside the head. So actually recognizing that's a big start. Because then you can stop identifying with the little me, and you can stop believing the big inner critic. Okay? That just recognizing it's a pattern. And then the thing is, like, how do we respond to that pattern? How do we work with it? Well, the first thing is to recognize it. It's like the first noble truth. There is dukkha. So there's some form of stress. Okay. And to recognize that there's this program, this pattern that says this is me, and realize that that's just a program, then rather than the truth. And that allows us to kind of step back and work with it. So the title of this talk was to meet clearing patterns through deep insight and great heart. So part of the things what I've seen is just seeing these things are programs, that they're not you, is kind of an insight, right? Just to notice that you've identified with these things, they're not you. And then the great heart piece is that what we want to do is open to these programs, these patterns. And great heart, I mean, it has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? Oh, yeah, I'd like to have that. It's something uncompressed, vast. It's got room for things to happen. It's a quality of spaciousness, that we're bigger than this little me. That's really not who we are. To really realize that we're really something vast. And it has a quality of presence, of here-ness, and that's the sense of being in the body. And really to be, in some sense, the sense of presence is really down the lower part of the body. When we move up in the head, the energy spins and causes trouble. So we really want to move down into the body ground, down into the hara. Be there. Okay, this is the way we work with difficult emotions, is to move into the body. And to have this sense of expansiveness. So a lot of times it's really useful to think about when you're having difficult emotions, just to soften and widen. And that means like soften the body, widen the attention, maybe even be aware of the space around you. This is part of great heart, that you're really big. Even to widen the mind, I always quote Joseph Goldstein's quote, which I love so much, you know, no matter what's going on, the sky is blue. You know, it kind of helps get the mind off of its locked down and narrowness. And this great heart has these qualities. It just brings what's necessary to the situation. It could be, you know, these what are called immeasurables, to bring a quality of kindness, compassion, quality of appreciative joy and equanimity. So compassion is, you know, kind of bringing this attitude, well, how can I help with this? How can I help with your own suffering? Kindness maybe sort of might be kindness to ourselves, kindness to this inner critic. And equanimity is just like allowing it to be the way it is, not to try and fix things. So when we can kind of step back, be bigger than this little piece is being beaten up, or bigger than this inner critic, then we can be with the energy, the emotions, just feel what's going on rather than believing them, to actually sense them. And with the inner critic, you know, we can actually decide, maybe become the inner critic. Be this voice that says all these things and ask it, you know, how things are. Bring a quality of compassion for it. You know, maybe even recognize how hard it must be to play this role. I mean, it thinks it's doing something good, right? That's how it got developed somehow. And maybe even welcome with a little bit of humor, you know, like, oh, I haven't seen you for 5 minutes. How are you doing? You know, and you know, when we really focus, when we become the inner critic and feel what's going on, it will disappear if we can be with it long enough. It deconstructs. We've kind of taken ourselves away from this little me and just inhabited this piece, and it doesn't have anything to fight with anymore. It's just got your attention. Okay, so that's kind of an example of how we kind of clear patterns. We recognize them, we, you know, and there's a nice little acronym that gets used a lot, RAIN. We recognize them. We allow them to be there, which is this great heart becoming more spacious. And then we come in and investigate them and get an understanding of them. We don't identify with them, which is the end part. So recognize, accept, allow. I like allow a little bit better than accept, because accept can sort of sound like resignation. Investigate and not identify. So I want to go through this rather than a particular example in a broader sense of what we're doing here. So the recognition part's pretty straightforward. The allowing part's pretty straightforward, I think. But I want to talk about the investigation aspect of it some. This investigation part involves really three things. One is attention, another is mindfulness, and another is awareness. And I tell you, I've listened to teachers talk about this word mindfulness, and there must be 10 million interpretations and definitions of what this word means. I'm obsessed about it. And I was listening to a talk today, and I just, you know, and it's just like, give me a break. You're just never going to straighten it out. I kind of wish that I have this fantasy somehow. I'm going to come up and tell everybody what mindfulness really means or something, you know. But it's not going to happen. But mindfulness, I'll be very clear, is not attention. Attention, there's actually a Pali word, manisikara. That's what attention means. And attention is the ability to focus. So the idea is, in this practice, is that we step back, we get wide and soft, and so we can calm. We have enough steadiness to be with things. And then we investigate. So then we're kind of zooming in. That's what attention does. And we're not supposed to just have any kind of attention. We're actually, there's this word, yoniso manisikara. It means either translated as appropriate attention or fathoming attention. So it's a particular kind of attention. It's not just like choiceless awareness was gets used. I mean, that's how I got taught, you know. It's really, you know, choiceless awareness can be like, you know, you go off and be aware of some story. I can't believe this person did this to me, and I'm going to get them, and da-da-da. And you're, you know, just then you start thinking, well, who am I anyway? And it's not that. It's like, it's an attention that's focused on, in some sense, these four ennobling truths. Okay, there's dukkha here, suffering, stress, dissatisfaction. So why is attention? Says, okay, there's some sort of stress here. And the second question it asks, the second ennobling truth is, what's the cause of it? So the attention is actually asking this question to focus in on, why are you having difficulty? You don't just kind of look, you want to really understand, what's the cause? And, you know, if you look at the second ennobling truth, it says the cause of suffering or stress, I'd like to use the word dukkha, but because it's much broader than that, but the cause of any inherent sense of dissatisfaction is what is called, so usually translated as craving. Wanting, and it, craving essentially means wanting things to be any way than they are. Because things are exactly the way they are in this moment, period. There's no multiverse here. Or at least if there is, we're in this verse, so we don't have a choice. So let's see, I lost my train of thought here. So this craving can be for sense experiences. You know, we're sitting, and then Ajahn Sucitto has this nice thing. It's like you sit for a while, and it starts becoming unpleasant. It becomes even more unpleasant. We're kind of like born in a pain body, you know. At some point, it can be. So then there's a reaction like, I don't want this. And that actually is a form of causing some form of stress, unnecessary stress. We can't do anything about the discomfort, but we don't have to add another layer of we don't want it. Or we see something we really want, and there's kind of a tension trying to get it. Or The more significant piece is this craving to become, to be someone, this craving to be an identity, this sense of me. So a lot of times when we start feeling some sense of stress or dissatisfaction, we can say, okay, are we trying to get rid of some sense experience? Or is there some sense of identity here that doesn't like the way things are? So basically, stress is caused by some psychological or physical reaction of not wanting things to be the way they are. So just to kind of see this. And then the thing to do is to investigate, well, why is this craving here? What underlying beliefs or perceptions, this perception is this interpretation of heart that's causing that? So let me join me with this. I imagine everyone's got some form of dissatisfaction to work with. I know some of you, so I... you know, unless you're all awakened, you've got one, right? So to just like conjure up something, some sense of, not big, I don't want you walking out of here totally traumatized or anything, but just a little, maybe some kind of annoyance that maybe happened today or, you know, something that mild judgment you have about yourself. And just bring that to mind. And see what is it that you don't want about it. So it could be some, you know, mild ill will. It could be some big time ill will towards someone that's mistreated you, like this girlfriend, my high school girlfriend. and then they're kind of like, okay, what kind of perceptions here is causing this? What belief system that's creating some kind of satisfaction, dissatisfaction? It could be, well, this person should behave a different way, which is maybe true, but they behave that way. So, I mean, the first thing is really actually ask if it's true, whatever your belief system is, to really investigate that. Yeah, maybe we just have unreasonable expectations about people, or we expect people to be perfect. And then even if it's true, maybe this person just really walked all over you, right? Ask the question, is it stressful? Is this really helpful to have this view or opinion? Because, you know, I talked to a friend who teaches these immeasurables of Brahmaviharas, kindness, compassion, appreciative joy and equanimity. And I said, well, you know, I talked to her about this exercise I went through of trying to feel love for everybody. And I said, you know, it's just like, I'm the one who hurts from all this ill will, not them. She said, yeah, you tell people that. And they say, yeah, they don't look at it that way. They feel this person doesn't deserve kindness or love. But this person is not being affected by your thought processes. You are. And as long as you're holding a grudge, you're the one that's suffering from it. So you really want to take that in. And I'm not saying it's, you know, with some people, it really takes a lot of work. It was funny, I was listening to talk about Ajahn Sucitto. He says, you know, you can do this with anybody. And then he paused. He says, well, don't test me on that. Almost anybody. But it's something to work with, to see, to start realizing how that anger or ill will affects you. And maybe to reflect on how you can shift that, which might be, okay, this person's, you know, kind of been conditioned to live this way. Maybe it's not what you'd like them to be. Maybe it's not very good. But that's the way things are. And to see that it's causing some form of suffering or stress for you. So what's mindfulness have all to do with all this? Because basically what I've said right now is you're bringing wise attention to it. Mindfulness is to keep you on track. Mindfulness actually, the Pali word sati, actually means to keep something in mind. It has to do with memory. So if you're meditating, mindfulness, at least this is my interpretation of it, you know, but I think it's got some good grounds for it. You know, there's enough people to say it to believe it. You know, if you're meditating and you're trying to focus on the breathing process, mindfulness just says, come back to it. That's what mindfulness is. It keeps the attention in the right place. It keeps you from wandering off telling some story about, I can't believe this person did this to me, it's ruined my life and all this sort of stuff. It's helping you just kind of focusing on the attention. You know, the wise attention, focusing on what's relevant, the moods, the emotions that are there, the bodily sensations, the energies that are flowing, just focusing in, just really being here with experience. And awareness is just, is really knowing what's happening. So the attention, wise attention, focuses you on the topic. Mindfulness keeps you on the topic. And then this awareness is this kind of sensitivity to know what's going on. And then maybe you'll notice, for example, that, oh, when this thought's not here, this dissatisfaction's not here. Or when this perception shifts, the dissatisfaction goes. Or sometimes you just sit with it long enough and you notice, oh, this is impermanent. It's not me. It rises out of conditions and it's gone. So that's kind of the practice. Maybe I'll just mention, you know, some personal examples. I have this defender piece because of things that happened to me. And so if someone, you know, it just crosses me a little bit, the reaction is just, I mean, I'm getting much better at it. I've been working with this for a long time. I sat on a retreat where just adrenaline flowed for a solid week. Out of something, it was really, in retrospect, pretty minor. But the memory, the thought came up, right? And so we'd be careful about our thoughts, because our thoughts affect our heart. The thought came up, triggered, heart responds, like, this person did this, they're da-da-da-da-da-da, and the adrenaline is just flowing. And then, okay, ground yourself, be in the body, widen, soften, and let this stuff flow. And it really sometimes takes a long time just to be patient with it. Another thing was, there was a time when my wife was just really not available. I mean, we had a kid that's got Asperger's, and she kind of a driven activist anyway, you know. And there was this sense of loneliness, just tremendous sense of loneliness. And, you know, for a while I kind of distracted myself trying to, you know, find other things to do. And then I had this thought, this, you know, that there was a belief system here. I really, like, I needed this attention. I needed her to fill me up. So that's kind of an investigative quality, to see that. And it's not always thinking about it. Sometimes it's just this realization comes from just being willing to be with it. And, you know, I go on retreats for 3 months. I don't read a paper. I'm not with anyone. And I'm joyful. So it was kind of a realization, like, oh, I was just with the feeling of loneliness. And I can't tell you how it shifted. It's just a willingness to be with it. I mean, a lot of the stuff's locked in the body. Just a willingness to be with it. Somehow it released. And then the relationship just shifted dramatically. It was a relationship out of joy rather than out of need. So this is how the process works, okay? Just to kind of recognize there's some sort of suffering, stress, dissatisfaction. See if we can open to it, expand, soften, widen, kind of explore what's causing it. And this isn't really so much thinking about it. It's just kind of coming in the sense of the energetic qualities and the moods and being willing to be with them. And not seeing as that is who we are. And if we can just be with it after a while, it just shifts. And so this practice really is about really creating skillful programs first. Kindness, compassion, simplicity. So we cultivate those. Meditation is a skillful program. It's kind of, meditation is really about not doing. It's trying to undo all this compulsive doing we do. And then when we feel good enough, we have enough healthy sense of self, you could say it, or a healthy set of programs, then we can just be with what's there. And the end game is to end all programs, including this program that says, this is me. And when we do this, there's something transcendent. There's something compassionate, non-opinionated, at ease. This whole sense of there's a union that takes place. This whole sense of subject, object, me and the other person dissipates. This is actually what a Zen master I used to practice with called true love. No separation. No subject, no object, no separation. So it's this mind, this thought process that separates. And when we clear all these programs, we clear the sense of a me, then there's no object to it. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop there and open up to any questions on anything. It doesn't have to be relevant to what I talk with about tonight. Yeah.
You talked about the monk who was talking about pain body, and I wondered what this monk's solution was. You know, so you're sitting there and you're having a lot of pain, and it's chronic, it's a lifetime thing, and yet you're meditating.
Yeah.
And you're clearing your mind and you're expanding whatever.
Right.
And your body, the longer you sit there, the more it hurts.
Right. Right.
Well,
I think there's a number of things. I mean, first is to separate the physical pain from the mental reaction to it, and notice how the mind contracts around the physical pain. It becomes your whole world, and then the body tightens up, which makes it even worse. So if you just kind of notice, oh, there's a mental reaction to this, and there's the physical aspect of what's going on, and seeing if you can kind of then widen the attention some, which is, this big heart thing in some sense, soften, widen, greater sense of space, and to focus on particular parts of the body that don't have pain. So, and this is not easy. I mean, I used to go to Forest Refuge, and I'd tell myself I'll sit for 2 hours. So it would get unpleasant, so I could work with it, which seems kind of crazy, right? But it's a skill. It's something you train, because we can't line things up, so they're always nice, right? So there are parts that if you focus on your buttocks or down here or the hands or the feet, they tend to be okay. Well, maybe not. I don't know. My feet are always okay. I don't know about yours. Where's your pain?
Oh, it's my spine.
Your spine, yeah.
I think I was thinking if I focus on my nose, I'll be all right.
I mean, there is like shifting to like the whole breathing process. You know, a lot of times we talk about being with the breath, but Buddha's really talking about being with the breathing process. It has a kind of rhythm to it. You can even, there's a nice little thing where he talks about these three aspects of the breathing process. So there's the muscles that move the breath. You can feel the solar plexus, the diaphragm tighten, expands the belly, the chest expands on the in-breath. On the in-breath. So there's kind of a swelling you just pay attention to that part of it, and then how it contracts. That's one part of the breathing process. Another part of the breathing process is actually to feel the air moving. You know, you can feel it coming in through your nostrils and coming down through the esophagus. You can even imagine it moving through the whole body. And then, you know, the feeling the exhalation. Another part is to be at the energetic part, which I tried to talk to a little bit when we began the talk this evening. It's just noticing how the energy increases on the in-breath and out-breath. And so you start focusing more on this rhythm. It just kind of distracts the mind from what's going on in the pain some. There's a really, there's a website called Access to Insight. And probably if you just put in a little search box, pain. But there's a nice little talk by Ajahn Chanisero, who had malaria. And he actually goes through in great detail how to work with pain. So it has to do with things like focusing on the other side of the body, or with back, of course, I guess a little bit problem, I guess, but focusing on parts of the body that don't feel painful. I don't remember the rest of it, but it's a nice little guide for that sort of thing. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, can we put the pressure on you here? Okay.
Hold it like an ice cream cone like this.
Okay. Thank you for the guidance,
hello,
sir.
Hello, okay. So I have a question on kind of on awareness and dividing it between mind, heart, and body when you're meditating.
Yeah.
Because right now at my stage, I am focusing on kind of deep awareness and mindfulness. And it ends up being kind of losing touch with my body and more kind of just like as a like a true self kind of in like, you know, an awareness form, which feels more like emotion mind. And what started happening in like the meditation before this and other times I've done this is I start, it's almost like I'm falling asleep, but I'm completely aware. I'm completely awake, but my body like will like, what is that?
Yes, tough questions. So your practice is really to be aware of the awareness, right? Is
that at this point?
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, should I be integrating the awareness into my body more, or across the three?
That's a tricky question. I think teachers would answer a lot of different things.
Yeah.
You know, there have been some teachers like Ajahn Sumedho, who was ran the Chidhurst Monastery in England, and he retired, and then Ajahn Sucitto, I really like, took over, and now he's retired. But one of the things that Ajahn Sumedho said is he thought insight meditation was too object-oriented, and that there ought to be more focus on awareness than knowing. And there's a lot of value in that.
So this insight method that's here is not specifically awareness. There's more than the awareness.
Well, my perception, and I haven't taken classes here for a long time, my perception here is that the meditation's more object-oriented. You know, it's noticing like the body and noticing how things... Well, if you think about the discourse on mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, mm-hmm. The first focus or foundation of mindfulness is awareness of the body.
Yeah.
Okay, and you're aware of there's like six different things, you know, but contemplation of death and the body parts and all this is very object oriented. Mm-hmm. And it has some use. Partly is it, you know, even at the level I talk about it, just being aware of its vibrations and energetic qualities and things like that. It helps diffuse the sense of identity.
And if your back is hurting, you should continue to focus the awareness on the body anyways.
Well, I wouldn't say just focus on the body. I think you want to also pay attention to the mental reaction to the body hurting.
Yeah.
So you really want to kind of, you want to look at the mental reaction to it. So the first part is focusing on the body. The second part is focusing on what's called vedana, which is just whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's not emotions. It's just, this feels nice, this doesn't feel nice. It could be emotion, it could be the body. And you notice that what happens is that it changes all the time. You just can't always have pleasant Vedana. And so, you know, this is like a core teaching in Buddhism. You can't line it up, so you got to find a better way. And the other thing about Vedana, the reason that the Buddhas separated out, and I'll just say feeling tone again, is that it. What happens is there's contact, which, you know, could be like you hear something or there's a sense experience, you know, your back hurts or something. And from that contact, what happens is two things. There's what's called perception, which is this heart's interpretation of that contact, and there's a feeling tone. And out of that, much more complex parts of what we are, emotions and thought processes, come. So if you just, so in some sense, this insight focus of kind of seeing like, okay, there's contact, there's, then arises out of concept, out of contact, perception and feeling, and then more complex emotions arise. It's kind of seeing that we're nothing solid. We're a whole bunch of events occurring over and over again. So that has some real value to it, right? You know, you can say, "Well, okay, I'm just going to be with awareness," and a realization in a lot of traditions, in the Thai forest tradition and Tibetan tradition, is some people, and in probably Advaita tradition, is "I am awareness." That's who I am, which is something that's fine with everything, not pushed around, not pulled around, which is really a nice place of rest. Just focusing on a knowing quality. I've got people I'm teaching, I'm having to do that now. But really, where does awareness come from? It's the coming together of conditions. So even this "I am awareness" is kind of like a little bit of ego there.
And you have to be aware of the awareness, and then you can never be fully aware.
Well, yeah, I mean... I mean, people say awareness is just there. I mean, I've been actually doing a lot of that with myself recently. But really, what the Buddha is teaching is that we're the coming together of conditions. And awareness itself is kind of a manifestation of conditions. And you're going to get a lot of teachers and really renowned teachers. I mean, not just sort of... you know, renowned in the Western tradition, but, you know, that will tell you you are awareness. But from a Buddhist perspective, you're what we call sunyata, emptiness, no core, no center, everything comes together. And there's some metaphysical stuff that awareness is generated by that. Okay, so back to your question. Why do you flinch? I don't know. You know, I mean... Maybe there's just like some...
Maybe that happens to you?
Yeah.
Do you ask this question to anyone
else? Yeah, I don't know. I mean...
It's not sleep, though. I was just like, I was afraid that I was doing something wrong and falling asleep.
Do you feel like you're going to fall over or anything when it's happening?
But like, what happens when you see someone like falling asleep? Like, kind of...
Starting to fall asleep.
But I like totally was awake.
Yeah.
I don't know either.
Yeah, so what happens when you do that?
I just... I'm aware, so
it doesn't bother you. Yeah. So it's just nature playing itself out, right?
That's interesting. That's exactly. Oh, you notice it?
You just notice it, and then, right?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sorry. Sarah? Back here?
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Isabel.
It was interesting, you just said when you were saying rain, you said recognize, well, that's easy, or something, that's, and then you said allow, okay, I'm thinking, really? And then you went on, and I, for me, allowing is difficult.
Yeah.
And I, too, had things to deal with in the past, so I think it's related. And I'll share what, when we had this exercise, of focusing on something that happened, I focused on something today, and it had to be with me. I work in a demanding environment, competitive, and I had done 8.5 hours of work. So I thought, it's time to leave. Well, I felt guilty because my boss was still there, and other colleagues were still there,
yeah.
And I thought I should be there. And I thought, no, I'm leaving. And besides, I want to attend the talk. And I thought I might even announce, but Mary was beat me to it. So so I said, okay, why am I feeling, so I'm feeling uneasy and guilty. And then I said, okay, so when I said, let me feel it, then it goes. I don't feel it. It stays in the mind. And then another thought comes that says, oh, it's okay, you know, or something that will come to my rescue to make it better somehow, that I don't need to feel guilty because something like that.
Well, do you force the thought or does it just come?
It comes from a new habit, maybe,
yeah.
of giving myself support. But I would like to stay with the feeling, and it doesn't come. I don't allow it, or it rather, it's difficult to allow it right then when I'm dealing with that sensation. It's when I say, okay, I'm going to feel it, it's nowhere to be found. It's hard for me to feel it in the body.
So when you say it's okay, when you tell yourself it's okay, is it a sense of denial or is it really...
Oh, no, it's right.
You really
there.
Feel it's okay.
Yeah.
I don't see that as a problem.
No, and it's more like, you're going to feel better in a while, don't worry.
Oh, okay, that's more denial.
No, but I do feel better. It's like, of course, it was the right thing to leave, to do. But...
Well, you'll feel better. You say you'll feel better in a while, but yeah. Do you feel better right away?
Pretty soon, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I've been struggling with that thought.
Yeah.
Quite a while that it's hard to leave work, because and not become a workaholic.
Right.
In that environment.
Yeah.
And I have a long commute, so it's 12-hour days easily.
Yeah. I mean, there is all this conditioning, right? All this social competitive conditioning, peer pressure that you should be a particular way.
But regardless of what the situation that I evoked, it's hard for me to stay to feel in the body and to allow it.
Yeah. Well, I think seeing if it can widen, soften.
Yeah.
Just widen the attention. And just maybe notice the thought and see if it is it really pushing things away or is it just really heartfelt? You know, I was doing walking meditation and this image of myself as a little boy came up. Mm-hmm. And there was just this voice that just said, oh, you poor thing. Mm-hmm. It was just really heartfelt. It wasn't concocted at all. And then after a while, it said, it's okay now. But that was sincere.
Right.
You know, and so I think you really just kind of need to check that out.
I did say when I was talking back, I was actually imagining a part of myself that was very young.
Yeah.
So I was saying, it's all right.
Yeah.
Like more compassionate.
Yeah, well, that's great.
Yeah.
Compassion is wonderful. I mean, I think all this stuff really needs a lot of that, really caring for stuff that we just really rather not be around, but rather than, I mean, it has to be cared for.
It's the allowing the sensation or the feeling that's still...
It's hard to do.
That is hard to do.
Yeah, but part of the role of compassion is to make it possible to allow it.
Yes.
And if it goes away because there's caring for it, maybe that's all it needs. I don't know.
Okay.
You know?
Right.
You've sort of seen it. I mean, you don't have to prolong it.
Exactly.
You just want to be careful about whether you're kind of rationalizing away. But if you're just really feeling caring for it, maybe that's all it needs. And maybe it needs it a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's the situation so many people face, right? All this peer pressure to accomplish, be there, work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have difficulty understanding the experience of, there's all kinds of language, abiding, being with, letting it be. For me, it feels like more an involuntary, when you're talking about life being a sequence of events, it feels more like an involuntary event that arises, just like a moment between states of anxiety or all kinds of difficult emotions. So I don't really know how to cultivate that or allowing. You know, it's more thoughts about rather than a real internalization or experience of, oh, that's what that is, to be with. And it feels like it's so central to this cycle or process.
Okay, so maybe just hold the mic up a little closer. I can hear you, but I think.
Pardon me?
No, you don't have to do it. You have to do it again, but just we're going to go on a little bit here. So could you give me an example?
Well, whatever. Oh, that's what I see. Whatever.
Closer.
Yeah, I got it. whatever the it is, those many parts of ourselves with which we have such difficulty and don't want to, don't welcome, don't accept, don't allow, just want to change and have things be different.
Right.
So I understand intellectually, cognitively, that the allowing, being with, abiding is another word that's used a lot in Buddhist teachings, meditation teachings. It's central to this, either the shorter cycle of going through with one moment or event or feeling, difficult feeling, anger, jealousy, anxiety, insecurity, but also as part of the longer process of repeating that again and again towards, well, you said widening, softening. I don't really know how to do that, I guess, to say that simply. So to me, it's just like sounds. It's like,
yeah,
when someone speaks a language you don't understand, it's just a sequence of sounds.
So let's say, if you have a particular example, I use it, but if you don't, I'll make one up. So let's say someone insults you or criticizes your work or something like that, okay? And then there's a heart response to that, right? It's like, this doesn't feel good. So the practice would be, you really want to do is be in your body. You want to think about it. You want to just... So I think the first thing would be to ground yourself. Feel your buttocks on the chair. Feel the breathing process. Just bring your attention to that. Don't get into stories. Just feel what it's like. So that's part of the allowing process. You're not trying to fix it. You're not telling some story about it should be some other way. You're kind of letting go of that thought process. And you're just feeling the body. And then you can even ask yourself, how do I know what's going on here? It's unpleasant, right? How is it unpleasant? Where is it unpleasant? That's allowing, being with the unpleasantness. And, you know, the way we, you know, if you don't do some sort of trained practice, the thing is to deny it somehow, to rationalize it, try and fix it, you know, that sort of thing. This practice is, well, there's some really embedded stuff here. And the only way we're going to get free of it is to meet it and allow it to express itself. So that means you stop fixing, because that's just another part of you fighting one part of you. It's all happening inside the head. There's nobody out here that can fix it. And you just allow it to express itself. And a lot of this stuff's really locked in the body. This is really, you know, that's why the body is so important. It's not just the kind of thought process or view or opinion. It's like we've been conditioned. What happens is when we get hurt or things happen to us, we start tightening the body up and holding it so we don't have to feel it. And that's why it's so important to come down into the body, soften, allow it. And of course, it's unpleasant. You don't want to be with it. And that's the hard part of it. You just kind of have to have some, you have to have some faith to push it to the edge of discomfort. And you be careful because you don't want to re-traumatize yourself. So there's a delicate boundary here, but see if you can be with it. And sometimes maybe the way to deal with it is to do some walking meditation, just walking rhythmically or something. Or just being aware of the rhythmic movement of the breath. Some way to allow yourself to be with it. And it just takes some patience for it to kind of release.
Yeah, it's helpful, help? Thank you. Okay, it's transcending all the cognition, because it's just more layers of self-talk.
Yeah. You have to just be with it. I mean, believe me, I've done retreats where my first self-retreat I went on for 6 weeks, and I thought it was, because I was very good at concentrating, I was very pleasant. At the end of every sitting, I wanted to get up. I didn't know why, I just wanted to get up. And I'd start crying. And I thought, it's going to be like this for 6 weeks. But, you know, after about 8 days, I mean, that's how much it took. There's just this flow of energy up and down my back. There's a release, but that's sometimes what it takes. So it really takes a lot of skill. And it kind of relates to your question of awareness. I mean, it's like if you just, the body helps you dissipate all this stuff. So it's a tricky question about where to focus. About, yeah. Okay. One more. Yep. Can you get a mic over here? And I'll be glad to stay and talk with people afterwards if there's not time. We can talk after this if you want.
I just wanted to, on this subject, what occurs to me and something that I use quite often is labeling. And I take this from Ajahn Sumedho, who often repeats, it's like this,
yeah.
It's like this,
right.
It's like this. And it helps, I think, to characterize what you're feeling, because otherwise you're just like in an emotional battle back and forth and you don't know what you're dealing with. But if you can identify, this is anxiety, or this is remorse, or this is, you know, being able to characterize it and then identify it, maybe even as a mantra, can help.
Yeah, a lot of people find labeling helpful, it helps you kind of lower the level of anxiety, of emotion, by just kind of labeling it rather than getting caught up in it. So yeah, it's a teaching some people like and others don't.
Oh, you don't like it?
I don't use it. And, you know, I practice with teachers who teach it a lot, like Joseph Goldstein. You know, I practice with him a lot. You know, he might say, okay, you know, anger, and then you see underneath that maybe there's hurt. You say hurt. What I don't like about it is that it conceptualizes it. So, you know, that's just my view.
Well, the one thing that I get from it is an immediate sense of distance from it.
Yeah.
So that I'm not right up against it.
Yeah. And I think
it gives me breathing room.
Yeah, it's really good in terms of giving some distance from it, allowing you to be with it. I think it's really useful for that. But in some sense, I also think you need to connect with it. So it's that kind of balance that takes place. But yeah, I'm not at all putting it down because there's a lot of people who teach it. Yeah. It just, for me, it doesn't, my way. You want to go and squeeze one more in? Yeah, sure.
Okay. So I'm pretty much a beginner at this. And when you're talking about an insult or a hurt from somebody, I'm kind of with you. I can conceptualize how I would go through that process. But I guess I'm struggling right now with a new job. And I thought it would be rewarding and exciting, and instead I'm just finding it really stressful and overwhelming, and I'm counting the days until I can quit. And I'm recognizing I'm very good at that, and I can see how this is a program that I'm pushing the button and thinking these thoughts over and over again, but I guess I'm stuck at that next step of opening and widening. I don't get what that means.
Well, it's okay. I, you know, you realize what's here. You don't like this job. and you're here. You're in the job, right? So while you're there, you can start just sort of say, okay, I'm going to try and get out of this, but for now I'm here. So where am I adding unnecessary stress? You know, it's like, what don't you like about it? And then can you, you know, find a way to be with that?
And that's where I get confused. I can tell you exactly what I don't like about it, but what do you mean by
it? Okay, tell me, give me an example, okay? I'm sure you can.
Yeah, sure. So I'm teaching second grade, and the students are just constantly having little fights with each other, and I feel like I'm responsible for teaching these children to be kind, and that's overwhelming when I'm also supposed to be keeping up with the academics and the box tops and the permission forms and everything, and I'm like, I don't want to deal with your little problems.
Right, but you have to deal with them, right? Yeah. So the thing is to take each one of these things, okay? Notice, children are fighting with me. There's a reaction to this. I don't want it to be this way. But it is this way. So you can look at the mental response to this, an emotional response to it, and see if you can open to it and really find a way to be with it, which partly probably means coming down to your body, maybe taking some breaths, watching the thoughts. Now, of course, it's hard when you're in the middle of the fire. But it's kind of taking each situation and see if you can kind of look at the thought process and the emotions that are driving it and recognizing, like, it's the way it is, and see if you can kind of, like, soften into it, soften, widen your attention. I mean, it's not easy, but it's just kind of like pausing. You know, what might happen is it happens, there's a really strong emotional reaction, and then maybe if you just say, okay, I got to pause, take some breaths, soften a little bit. You know, it's not going to become pleasant, but it might take a little bit of reaction to it, out of it. That's the general idea behind it. So, okay, so I should bring this to an end. It's been a delight to spend the evening with you, and enjoy your April Fool's Day. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.